that they will be available like a lot of goodies.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So contact Luke if you want to get on that distribution list, and we'll make it a very specific distribution list. So depending on the size of the file, we'll zip it or send a link, or we'll figure that technical part out here later this week. All right. So this is our second class in covering the book of Ecclesiastes. So today we're going to be looking at kind of this big question, right? What gives meaning to life? Okay. Or perhaps maybe a better way of asking is who gives meaning to life, right? So we'll see that's kind of where we end up. We're going to be looking at the first three verses of the book, and then chapter 12 at the very, very end, the last verses, 8 to 14. So that's going to be the focus today. One thing you're going to see as we go through this study is we're not going to progress through the study, you know, verse by verse by verse. We're going to cover all the verses, but we're going to group the verses in the themes that they talk about, okay? Because the way the book is put together, there's a lot of repetition in different spots, okay, in the book. So rather than, and so it does make it sometimes difficult to follow because that's the case. But like we talked about last week, the book is designed or written in a way for you to read the whole thing, ponder it, read the whole thing, ponder it, read the whole thing and ponder it. Okay. It's not, it's put together artfully and meant for you to spend time with it. Okay. And it's like any piece of good art. It's the purpose of art is to communicate not only truth, okay, but other aspects that of beauty, okay, and those are not things that are meant to be consumed quickly, okay. This isn't fast food literature, okay. It's not McDonald's literature, okay. This is God's word given to us, and it's a subject, of course, that is quite complex, quite frankly, right? I mean, the meaning of life is not. I can't boil it down into just one simple little trite, you know, statement. Okay. So, in 1982, there was a book that was published, with the title, Life, the Universe and Everything. Some of you may have read it. It's the third book in a six-book trilogy, okay, and I did say that correctly, right? There's six books in the trilogy. What? Yeah. So it's the third book, right? And it's called, and the title was Life, the Universe, and Everything. And I did read all the first three. First one is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's pretty well known. This book is it's comedy, okay, so to speak, right? So Long and Thanks for All the Fish was the second one. And then finally we got to this one, Life, the Universe and Everything. And I read it in high school and I was so excited, you know, what's the answer to this? You know, where are we going to, you know, what is the meaning of life, the universe and everything? I mean, obviously this guy had the gumption to write a book with that title. Perhaps he knows something. I don't know. Right. I mean, that was kind of my thought as a high schooler. And then, of course, as many of you know, you get to the end of the book, and the protagonist finds the answer, and the answer is the number 42, okay? And you sit there and you're like, what does that mean? And so, you know, I actually Googled this week, you know, what does the number 42 mean? Where did it come from? And Douglas Adams, the author, refuses to answer that question. But there's a book you can buy on why the number 42 is, in fact, the meaning of life.
He knows the answer now.
Yeah, he knows the answer now, yeah. Okay. So there's a book someone wrote on why the number 42 is, in fact, the meaning, right? But that book itself is tongue-in-cheek, it's basically a comedy. But what is he really saying? Because Douglas Adams actually is onto something. And he's in agreement at some level initially with the book of Ecclesiastes. And that is that there is something about life, okay, under the sun, because that's the perspective that he's looking from, clearly, that is meaningless, okay? Right? And that's kind of the conclusion that he's coming to. And you see this throughout literature, lots of places. You know, in not only music, but literature and other thoughts, or I should just say, you know, people who strive to find meaning under the sun oftentimes will come to the same conclusion. So there's one other book, and by the way, these are not recommendations, okay? So, all right, I'm in no way recommending these books. This is just happens to be, you know, and there's a million books and music and you could use to illustrate these points, by the way. These are not anything special. So there's another book, maybe a little bit less known to everyone here, that won the Pulitzer Prize in 1974, and it was called The Denial of Death. And it's had a big impact on society different ways. It was in President Clinton's top 21 books he's ever read. And I don't know if you all know, but Clinton you know, used to read a book a day or whatever. He's a very prolific reader. So for it to end up on his list, you know, tells you that it's had a pretty significant impact on society, at least at some level, right? And what the author proposed in this book is that societies tend to have a huge, put a lot of effort and thought, okay, into denying their own mortality, okay, and that religion, and not just religion, but mostly religion, you know, historically anyway, is geared toward this concept of how to cheat death, right? How to, he titles his book The Denial of Death, but because the idea is that that societies always conjure up, okay, some way of dealing with our mortality, okay? And he calls it the vital lie, right? And it's called a lie because it's conjured up, right? We're just thinking of a way to deal with it. But he says it's vital because it's so important, right? This fear of death, right? This everyone knows, right, that they're mortal, right? But it's a terrifying thought. And so societies deal with this one way or the other. And it's essentially a refusal to acknowledge your own mortality and to deal with it in a way that is satisfying to a person. So if you guys are familiar with ancient Egypt, right? How did they deal with the afterlife? Do you, anyone ancient Egyptianologists? They tried. Okay, so they viewed the afterlife as a bunch of stages. So they kind of equated it with crossing the river, right? And if you were a pharaoh, you could take a boat, right? So you had an advantage, okay, over everyone else. I guess everyone else had to swim or some other way get across the river. But it was these stages, and you would go through stages and stages and stages, kind of like going up the Nile River, where you had these stages where you had to cross the rocks to, you know, the falls, so to speak, to get up the river. They kind of equated the afterlife like that. But it was this work that you would do. And your funeral objects were real important, right, in order to assist you in that. You know, I grew up in Taiwan, and in the funerals that took place there, it wasn't unusual for there to be paper cars or paper airplanes, and always had a big palace that was made of paper with little bamboo. And these are miniature versions of things you had on Earth, and then they would burn them, right? And you're sending those items along to the afterlife, right, to help your deceased relatives have a better afterlife. So, you know, but you can see that even the Egyptians had their one way of thinking. What I had, you know, growing up in Taiwan, they had their one way of thinking. Ancient Greeks, so I wasn't actually familiar with this, but the Greeks believed, and I'm no expert on it, okay, so this is just the very high level, that a person existed in the afterlife as long as they were remembered here on earth. So your memory of a person, right, so I remember, you know, so-and-so, Alexander the Great. Well, that's good. Alexander the Great still exists in the afterlife. He's still wandering around in the smoky, filled, you know, afterlife, right? Because he's in my mind, right? So they had a very strong connection between memory and remembrance and existence in the afterlife. And interestingly enough, I think that that concept exists today in our culture, right? Like in a big way, right? You've heard it, right? I got to keep this so-and-so's memory alive, right? That's not an uncommon thing that you would talk about someone who's died and gone, right? I want to keep their memory alive or whatever. So anyone see the movie End of the Spear? It's about, you have, okay. So this is a movie about missionaries. They're in the Amazon and they're preaching the gospel to this tribe. So what are the tribal beliefs for the afterlife? Do you remember? It was like a big deal in the movie. You had to what? To get to the other side. It's similar to crossing a river. Jumping the boa. Yeah. You had to jump the boa. Yeah. So, you know, it's this idea that you die and there's this big snake. And if you can get on the other side of it, right, if you can make it on the other side, you'll have arrived, right? So and every culture, if you go through and you look at the cultures, are going to have a way to deal with this question, okay, of our mortality and what it is that we can do, okay, to in essence have some form of eternal life or some good afterlife or whatever like that, okay? All right, so the modern world, right? So now, what is it today, okay? There's a long list of things that we do in our culture today under the sun, okay? I'll be real clear about this, okay? Under the sun, right? This is what just our culture does. One is hedonism, right? Just pursuit of pleasure. If I can just find... pleasure. So this is a Douglas question. Okay. The Who, right? They sang a particular song called My Generation. And what's the famous line from that song?
I hope I die before I get old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they all made it past 30.
Yeah. They're still kicking, right? Oh, they're old guys, right? Kicking around, doing commercials, right? For stuff, right? Yep. Pete Townsend. So he's a high school kid, Pete Townsend, right? Right? And he's pinning these words to this song that becomes like a very famous song, right? And one of the lyrics is, hope I die before I get young. I hope I die before I get old, right? So what is he saying there? I mean, in that lyric.
Want to enjoy every bit, I guess.
Yeah.
Fast, die young, and good looking corpse.
Leave a good, yeah, yeah. But it's the ultimate denial of death, isn't it? Basically saying that I don't want to have anything to do with old age and with death. Like nothing to do with this. Like that is not, you know, on my radar. I don't want to address it. I don't want to deal with it. I'm going to enjoy my youth, my time here, and I don't want to even think about it, right? Right. Why do I need to think about it, right? If I die young, then I don't have to deal with mortality, so to speak, right? It's one way of avoiding it or whatever. And we could go on and on. That concept within pop culture is not at all uncommon. All right, let's move on. So what about life's work? What is your life's work? I'm going to leave a legacy. Have you ever heard that? Right? Right, and leave a legacy. So that means a little bit different things to different people, but this concept of leaving a legacy, oftentimes that is associated with funds, right? If you got a lot of money, right, you're gonna leave a legacy, and they're talking specifically about like donations to colleges, that kind of thing. When I was in high school, I heard a quote from Benjamin Franklin that really stuck with me. And it said, to be remembered in history, you must write something worth reading or do something worth writing. Okay. And he was answering the same question, right? How do you do you keep your memory alive? How do you have some sort of immortality, so to speak, right? Do something worth writing or write something worth reading. Power, respect, right? Those are very similar. Make your mark on society. Maybe put your name on a building, put your name on a stadium, right? Something along those lines. Get yourself a brick, right? With your name on it, right? Somewhere. How about, have you ever heard of the hero myth, right? Everyone knows what it is. They may not understand, they may have not heard the term, but this is the idea that you are a hero. If you want to be remembered in eternity, you want to give your life meaning, you just need to go be the hero. Okay? Right? I'm going to grab my AK, not my AK, I'm gonna, my AR, right? And I'm going to go kick some Russians, you know, out of Ukraine, right? Go join the Ukrainians, go fight, right? It means people do that. There's a lot of ways people be here, you know, think that if they could just do something that's heroic, right? And do something special and do something that's never been done before, right? Right. I'm going to go climb Mount Everest. Oh, sorry. It's been done already, right? I'm going to go to the deepest part of the ocean, right? I'm going to, you know, that kind of thought, right? So that's another one. How about doing the most good? Right? Right? So that's going to give me meaning in life. I'm just going to do the most good I can do, right? In charity. And doing good is not bad, of course. In fact, most of these things, not all of them, but most of these things are not necessarily, you know, evil in themselves. The question is, do you find meaning in them? Do they give you ultimate meaning, right? That's what the question we're dealing with. What about spiritualism or the occult, right? There's people who try to find meaning in that sort of thing. And then finally, at the end, some folks just simply slide into cynicism or nihilism, right? And they just give up, right? And that can be, you know, a state that a person can end up in. You find out that the answer to life is 42 and you believe it. And you're like, and you just kind of stop there, right? Like, there is no meaning in life. I'm just not going to care anymore at all. I'm not going to care about anything. I'm going to try to work the least amount I can and do the least amount of this and the least amount of that, right? And that's a sad, depressing way to live, quite frankly. It's not a healthy way to live, and it's not at all what Ecclesiastes is teaching. So, what about, so this is maybe, this isn't too tangential, but this is related, but what about in the church? So where do we see in the church, what branches of the church do we see this sort of, let's just say, unhealthy way of viewing life most, most expressed? And you know, the truth is, you probably could find it in all different branches of the church, but I'm thinking very specifically of the health and wealth gospel. And I mean, I don't know if y'all are familiar or know that, you probably do, but I mean, the health and wealth gospel is, that represents a millions and millions of people. I mean, it is a very, very fast growing. I know in Africa in particular, it's a huge movement, right? And in Asia, it certainly is. And then here it is as well. So why is it that you can pack a stadium with people here in the U.S. too, no problem, if you teach health and wealth and that flavor of charismatic movement? I mean, what's really going on there?
It's worshiping life.
Say again?
Worshiping life.
Mm-hmm. It is. But it's
tickling in the ears.
It's tickling the ears, yeah. But it's what it's doing is it's taking this question here and it's giving you an answer that you want to hear. Okay? That is there meaning to life? Yeah, there's, I can give you a formula. I can give you a particular teaching, right? A thing that you can do that's going to give you an advantage, right? It's going to give you an advantage in life. It's going to allow you to, in essence, kind of short circuit, you know, the way things go, and enable you to know the future and to get the future you want, ultimately, right? Whether, you know, health and wealth, right? Those are your two big things that people are looking for. But what does Ecclesiastes do, right? Ecclesiastes acknowledges, okay, that man's attempt at immortality, right, or an advantage. But Ecclesiastes does not leave us there. It provides us a solution. that recognizes that God alone gives eternal life and meaning to life. So where are we going in the book? It's this idea that that life under the sun, okay, will not give you ultimate meaning in life, but God does, okay? That when a person dies, God judges a person's life and gives it meaning, right? And that is, in essence, the most important application. And we're going to see that today as we look at the text. So what is Ecclesiastes about? And so what are we going to do today? We're going to look at that, which we've mostly covered here in a little bit, or in the introduction. Then we're going to ask the questions, which questions are being answered and asked in the book. And then we'll take a look at the epilogue, which is the last part of the scripture that we're looking at today. So how does the book begin? The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Okay, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? So it begins on this, it begins essentially with an answer, and then you're forced to ask the question, what is the question, right? What question is he answering? And I would propose that the question he's answering, the primary one, and there's others, but the primary one is in the very next verse, okay? So when you read verse 2, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He's answering this question of what advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun. And this word advantage is this idea of what are you going to get out of life, okay? And not just what are you going to get out of it, but what advantage do you have in your activity? So when he says work, you can think of activity, right? Like, you know, not just specifically your work, but your work is what the majority of your day is, you know, built around. So but it can be used a little more generic in the terms of, you know, your activity, what, you know, how you live your life, right? What you do, so to speak. What are you going to get out of what you do in life, right? In your work.
Not just a vocation, but just working at your house.
That's right.
Doing all that you do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So don't think work simply means vocation, right? It could be, you know, just how you live your life, your activities, your, you know, what do you, you know, how you, you know, how you live, right? So I think when especially in the ancient world, someone says your work, that's what they're talking about, right? Like your life, right? You know, there wasn't like this idea that, oh, I got my vacation time over here, right? You know, and I work 9 to 5. It's like, no, you know, it's like, no, your life is kind of your work, right?
It seems to kind of touch into what David was preaching about this week, where, you know, we can get caught up in the vanities of what people are should be as a Christian. Do you think that that's...
Yeah, we'll talk about that for sure. Because the book is certainly not teaching in any shape or form, okay, works-based salvation, okay? And this is something that Christians, non-Christians, religions in general, they all, you know, as Christians maybe struggle with that idea. As non-Christians, they tend to just embrace it, okay? This performance-based relationship with God, okay? Ecclesiastes is really addressing this issue of life under the sun. How do you live life under the sun? Okay, it's not, you know, it's not in contradiction to say the book of Romans by any means, but it's not the book of Romans either. Okay, so the goal of the book is not to teach you how to be justified by faith. Okay, that's not the subject matter at all. Absolutely.
That could become part of our vanity, pursuing that rather than the relationship with the rest of the
world. Absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Anyone, a person who has bought into works-based salvation would certainly see, could certainly use that as you know, their meaning in life, so to speak. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. Okay. So So what is Ecclesiastes about? Here's kind of a summary statement here. So the teacher, right, the preacher, right, he understands that because of the certainty of death, right, our mortality, humanity has an insatiable desire to give life meaning. And Ecclesiastes is an artful account of a failed attempt to find meaning apart from God and an authoritative guide to obtaining eternal meaning from the Creator who gives it. So at the end of the day, the teacher here wants us to understand with certainty that there is no, like, there's no secret knowledge that exists under the sun where if you just did that one thing or you just did these keys or whatever, that you would find ultimate meaning in what you do under the sun, right, apart from God. Okay, that those things don't exist. Don't spend your life trying to find them, right? Whether it's the hero myth or the, you know, trying to be the hero or this or that or those things we mentioned earlier, hedonism. You're not going to find ultimate meaning in life in any of those things, okay? And then he's going to come to a conclusion, and today we're going to actually go over that conclusion. That's the reason we're starting at the end rather than, you know, having everyone kind of wait and see what's going on. We're going to look very specifically at that conclusion today. So there are two other questions in the book other than in verse 3 that I want to bring to your attention because I do think those help clarify the questions that the book is asking and, of course, the answers, right, which is an important part. Because verse 2, meaningless, says a teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. That is an answer to a question, right? So what does he mean by everything? And this is something that trips people up. And the answer to that is found in this phrase, under the sun. Okay, that's actually 29 times in the book. So this is a major phrase, all right? It's used all over the place. The author doesn't want us to think that his view of meaninglessness, okay, or vapor, extends up into the heavens, okay? This is just a very, very important concept, right? Because if it did, okay, if God did not exist and there is no God, then this is nihilistic, right? That's essentially what it would be, that there is actually no meaning. There is no meaning at all. He keeps it under the sun for a very important reason, because there is something above the sun, okay? And every time you hear this phrase, under the sun, I think you're supposed to kind of think, well, that's interesting, because what's above the sun, right? So in creation, this is true. But what about outside of creation, right? On the other side, so to speak, right? On the other side of the river, right? If you use the Egyptian concept, what is it? So this answer of everything is meaningless. Okay, that everything there is governed by the concept of under the sun. Okay, does that make sense to everyone? It's real important, because what he's not saying in context, okay, is that life is meaningless with God or without God. He's not saying that. Life is meaningless, has no ultimate meaning apart from God, right, under the sun, okay? So that's an important concept, something that can trip people up. So the question in verse 3 says, what does man gain from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? So what he's looking for is a person, is that what is the advantage? Okay, this word here, gain or advantage, is kind of the idea that we would say in English, we would say something like, you know, what's the secret? What's the secret? What's the secret to life, right? Right? What's the advantage? What are you getting out of it? Like, what's the point, right? What's the meaning? Does that make sense? So it's that kind of word, right? Yeah, what's in it for me? Yeah, exactly, right? you know, I got married, right? I got a wonderful husband, right? But I'm still not fulfilled, right? There's still something. Oh, I just have a baby, right? Have a baby. Oh, that didn't quite work either. Right? Didn't quite work. That's a lot of work. So, you know, and I can't live vicariously through my child. Man, I thought I could, right? I know, I'm picking on mothers here, right? But men have the same story, right? Men have the same story, right? Man, if I could just, you know, if I can just, you know, get my driver's license, if I can just get a job, I can just make this much money, you know, if I can just climb the ladder, right? Just get my PhD, right? I'm picking out on everybody today, right? You know, David, if we only had a mega church, David, I mean, that's the problem, right? That's the problem. It is the problem, right? We just don't have enough members. We need to talk about that. No, right? You know, it's, you know, I mean, pastors think that way too. They can, they shouldn't, but they can, right? I mean, it's real easy for us to, it's like, you know, man, if we just had this, just, you know. I mean, you go to a pastor's conference, what's the first question people ask? How many members do you have? Right? Number one question, right? And yeah, so we all deal with this, regardless of your vocation or your place in life. So there's two other questions in the book, though, that have the exact same form as this one in verse 3. And I think this is important because there's a total of 16 total kind of rhetorical questions in the book. But two of them match this one in the exact like sentence structure, which is, I think, an important observation. So you'll notice that this question, verse 3, says, "What does man gain from his labor at which he toils under the sun?" So the other two questions are found in chapter 2, verse 22, and then in the second half of chapter 6, verse 12. So 12b, okay? Both of them end with under the sun. Okay, that's the second half of the question. Both of them begin, actually, the second one, so chapter 2, verse 22, the sentence is identical except for the verb. Okay, the exact same Hebrew sentence minus the verb. So in 2, verse 22, it says, "What does a man get from all his toil?" Okay, the question is, or I'm sorry, the phraseology there is, instead of the word gain, it's get. Okay, so what are the differences between gain and get, right? And this is important because the get question is kind of like your next thought, right? So if your answer to gain is meaninglessness, your next question is, what do I get, right, from my work? I mean, if you're telling me I can't find ultimate meaning, ultimate fulfillment, like eternalness, right, in the work that I do, then what do I get out of it? Like, what are the, you know, why live?
So maybe accumulate and receive might be parallel. I'm trying to get the nuanced difference between gain and get.
I would say gain implies something positive and get is neutral.
Yeah, yeah.
So gain is like, what good is going to come of this? What do I get from it? Well, what is the result, whether good or bad? What do I get out of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Positive or negative? Yeah, yeah. So one of them is what kind of eternal significance can I get out of life? And the other one is, well, if the answer is nothing, then my next question is, why bother living, right? So what is there in life? So what you're going to see is a lot of answers to that second question are in the book, okay? Where it will say, and this, a lot of the application in the book is in response to that question. Okay, I commend enjoyment, he says. I commend it, right? Enjoy life with the wife of your youth. enjoy life now because God has blessed you. He's given you the ability. So, and then he talks about contentment, right? So a contented enjoyment of life is a summary statement of what you can get, so to speak, out of your work, okay? And there's more to it at the very end. We'll talk about that. But under the sun, right, once again, under the sun, right, there is value to living, right? There is goodness in living, all right? But you find that goodness, right, in recognizing that life is a gift from God when you can enjoy it, when you can find pleasure in it. It's because God has so deemed that you can, right? God has given you today. You've chosen to worship him today here, okay? Great choice, okay? Really good choice, okay? I hope, you know, after this class that you're going to go up into the service and you're going to recognize that you being there is a gift from God and that you will receive it with thankfulness, contentment. It's not going to be a perfect service, okay? It won't. It's not going to be perfect, but you can be content with it, right? You can enjoy it for what it is, and take pleasure in being there and worshiping with the saints here today. And when you go home and you have your meal, you can choose to enjoy that as well, because that's a gift from God. You may die on the way home, okay, in your car accident, but you probably won't. But when you get home, right, you can do it. And I got to go to work tomorrow, right? Kent, everyone else goes to work tomorrow. And you have a choice to make, right? You know, you can complain, right? Right? Don't complain to me. Okay, I don't like hearing it. But you can, you know, or you can embrace it for what it is, right? It's not going to be perfect, but you can still choose to enjoy what you can of it and work towards that contentment and enjoyment of your work, right? Your vocation, whatever it is. And I'm not saying it's easy, because that's not the point, right? This is, but can you learn to enjoy something that isn't easy? Yeah. I remember the first 3 months I was at my job, right? I'm like, oh my goodness, how am I going to enjoy this, right? College was pretty fun, right? Compared to what I'm doing. But I learned, you know, I learned and I enjoy it. And I've been enjoying it for many, many years. So that's a very high level summary of what's going on for that question. Uh-huh.
I missed the third
question.
Where was that third one?
The third one I haven't talked about yet.
Okay.
But that one is in, and by the way, these questions are repeated throughout the book. So I said that there are 16 rhetorical questions. A lot of them are kind of like variations of the same question. So I'm just using examples of you know, I'm not going to go over all 16 today. So we don't have time. All right. So the third question, who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? That's Ecclesiastes 6, verse 12, second half. Who, now notice this one goes from what to a who. Pretty important idea, right? One last thing. Question number two. The answer to that question is found in what I'm calling just the nothing better statements. So there's four answers that begin with nothing better. There's nothing better for this, nothing better, nothing better, nothing better. And there's a couple that don't use the phrase nothing better. But anyway, we'll get to those when we get to them. But just be aware, you'll see that nothing better phrase. All right, back to question number three. Who can tell him what will happen under this after happen under the sun after he is gone? Since no man knows the future, who can tell him what is to come? Right. Ecclesiastes 8:7. Ecclesiastes 9:1. So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. But no one knows whether love or hate awaits him. So there is this additional question, third question, and that is, who can tell me the future, right? What, you know, and that question applies to a couple different things. It applies to your legacy, okay, your legacy, so to speak. Like, what's going to happen to my legacy after I'm gone? And he's going to talk about that, right? Like, you give all your money to your kids, and who knows whether they're going to be wise or a fool. They may just go blow all that money, right? And whatever, right? You know, you're going to get yourself a nice gravestone. That's great. Okay. One day that gravestone will make a good paving stone, right? Someone's going to take that gravestone and use it to build their house with it, right? And they'll be walking all over your name, right? Okay. Archaeologists are going to dig your body up. They're going to open your stomach and see what your last meal was. Okay. That's pretty dark. Okay. Okay. But who knows what's going to happen, right? Who knows what's going to happen to my gravestone, right? To my landmark, my legacy, right? Who knows, right? I mean, I would like to know, right? I mean, I would like not just to know, but I need a way to guarantee it, right? The pharaohs went to great lengths to you know, try to protect that legacy, right? To become, you know, to put some sort of permanence, okay? And the next pharaoh shows up. What do? They get that real expensive statue that you spent a lot of money getting it carved, and they carve your face off, okay? And they put their face on it, and then they take your name, your cartouche, and they whack it, right? They put their own cartouche, right? And your spirit leaves, choop, it's gone, and their spirit goes in, too bad, right? Or they just knock your head off, right? You know, who knows what's going to happen? You know, I would like someone to guarantee me that my legacy is going to be, like, permanent. But the answer is the future's in God's hands, okay? So he starts to introduce the who into this last question. And we're getting this pivot from, you know, from looking only under the sun to looking above the sun. And so he starts to, you know, kind of point us in that direction, that the meaning in life is going to be connected to ultimately not to what's under the sun and what we do, but the who, right? And that is God. The future is in God's hands. So notice, by the way, that question, under the sun, after he is gone. So there's very much this idea of legacy, right? Of, you know, after I'm gone, right? Who's going to tell me what's... So it's less of a question about tell me my future, like before I die, but more tell me the future, what's going to happen after I'm gone, right? So it's a very interesting question. We don't typically ask that question too much, but it's an important one if you're building your life around legacy. You know, if like that's your meaning of your life is your legacy, what you leave. Well, this is actually an important question, is what's that legacy going to be? Right? Right? You can put your name on the stadium, but they'll take it off. Right? They'll sell it to the highest bidder when you're dead. Right? My kids used to be in the bell choir. And it was funded by a very wealthy family here in Fort Worth. And as soon as the last person connected to that family died, what did they do? What did the heirs do with that money? There's no more bell choir. You know, I don't know if you all knew that. But they found something better to spend the money on. The heirs did. Okay, so the epilogue. We'll finish here. Chapter 12. Verse 9 to 14. And we're going to repeat a lot of these themes throughout the book. So don't, it's been a little bit of a rush, but the whole book is going to support the themes we're talking about today. So we are going to see a lot of repetition and supporting arguments that are going to roll up to these. All right. So he repeats, the kind of the main theme of the book, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. That's verse 8. Verse 9, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. He pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. The last kind of third of the book is a collection of proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words, okay, beautiful, literally beautiful words. We talked about that last week. And to write words of truth correctly, okay? So he's building his resume, right? This is why you need to listen to me. The words of wise men are like goads, okay? And masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They're given by one shepherd, okay? So they're something you can hang your hat on, we would say, all right, in Texas and in English, okay? These are words that you can hang your hat on, okay? They will support the truth here is true, and they will support you. Support what they're meant to support, put it that way. Verse 12, But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. Okay? This is a warning that's actually similar to the book of Revelation at the end, where it said don't add or subtract, right? So he's essentially saying that at least in regard to this subject, the subject of the book, okay, I'm closing the book on it. Kind of a neat thing to say, actually, right? But it's something you would expect to find in God's Word. I wouldn't put it in any other book that wasn't divinely inspired. But he says, in essence, I'm giving you the final word, the final thought on this. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep His commandments, because this applies to every person. And then this is real important. For God will bring every act to judgment and everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Okay? So the theme of God judging a person is found throughout the book. We'll talk about that in other places as we get to it. So this isn't the first time he's mentioned judgment by any means. But his conclusion is, in essence, to look above the sun, right? That you're going to find your meaning, right? You're going to find eternal significance above the sun, because it is God whose domain it is in the heavens above the sun. That's his domain, right? That's where he resides. And obeying and fear. So, by the way, the fear here is it's the concept of reverence, right? It's a reverent fear. That's always the idea of fear. So it's not fear that you're afraid of a deity who's mean or evil. OK, that's not what is meant by fear. Fear is in when we're talking about the fear of God in the Bible, it's always a reverence, a fear, an understanding that God has the power to judge, the power to set your eternal significance. Right. He has the ability to take what you've done, okay, and turn it into something that is eternal, right? Jesus said, if you give a person a cup of water, that's going to be remembered, okay? God is going to take that act, very small act, okay, of giving someone who's thirsty a cup of water. And Jesus said, God is going to take that and reward you for that. Right. Is there anything smaller than that? I mean, that's pretty little. And yet Jesus is, I think he's very specifically choosing something that is small, right? Because the principle there is that if God is going to make that small act relevant in eternity, how much more so will he make the larger acts? Okay, that's the principle. Okay. And so that's the answer. That's the conclusion. That's where meaning is found, is that God gives it to you, right? So your eternal significance is bound up in God's decision, his judgment, right? Now, once again, this is not judgment into whether you're a member of God's family or not, okay? Paul says in the book of Romans, chapter 14, we're all going to stand before God's throne in judgment, right? Paul, right? Paul's saying, yeah, what I do, how I live, right? And there's other things that Paul says, right? Where, you know, he says, my hands are clean. So he's thinking about that, you know, his legacy, so to speak, right? But it's very clear that as Paul's teaching, that his legacy, right, per se, is 100% going to be determined by God's act, right, as he stands before the judgment seat of Christ, or judgment seat of God, okay? And once again, you're not being judged as to whether or not you've done enough good works to get into heaven, okay? That's not the judgment we're talking about, okay? That judgment has been done based on the blood of Christ, okay? That's the answer to that question. What we're talking about here is eternal rewards, right? The significance of your life, okay? And this is important, by the way, right? I mean, I think it's popular nowadays to think of life as, you know, like everything is just like even, right? Like everything's fair. God's, you know, but God's going to be fair, so to speak, but not in the communistic sense, okay, where he's just going to dole out rewards in heaven, like identical to everyone. That's not what the Bible teaches. Right, David? I'm not being a heretic here. Right?
The Bible also says, don't worry about what John gets. That's my decision.
Exactly.
And you can't really compare.
Mm-hmm.
Your life with someone else's.
It's not a competition, right? No. It's not like God has just a certain amount of real estate up there and it's limited, so he's just kind of, you know, it's not that kind of thing, right? So we will talk about this concept a lot more as we go through the class, but the takeaway today is that God gives meaning to life. He does it, right? When he takes what you've done, right, that has been done for his glory, and he turns it into an eternal reward, right, in heaven forever. And so your legacy, so to speak, it's not going to be eternally right here on earth. It's going to be ultimately in heaven. And guess what? That's where it matters, right? We all agree. That's where it matters. That's where it matters. So we'll close here. I think we're right at time. Any last questions? Anything that's like bothered you?
Can you think of any ways that we could, I guess, word that or ways for us to remind ourselves of that concept when we start to be wistful of the things that, like, because I think it's easy for us to get sucked in with around us, but we're living in the world, just not of it. But we can think that, well, if I purchase this thing, or maybe I should pick up this technique if you're saying or whatever, like as if that's going to make life more meaningful.
Yeah.
What's a practical way of applying that, like that, remembering that concept, whether it's
that's a great question. So it's easy to be caught up in fads. Right. And to kind of bounce around. I mean, you know, James talks about being tossed around on the ocean, right, where you're constantly, is this or that or this or that.
How do we snap out of that, I think?
Yeah. So my best advice, right, and I think the biblical advice is to focus on the gospel, like have a really clear, crystal clear understanding of what the gospel of Jesus Christ is. You'd be amazed how many Christians couldn't define the gospel very well. I mean, we're having this conversation about performance-based salvation. I mean, that's not the gospel. Like, it's not, right? The gospel is not you perform and if you perform at this level, then God will let you in. That's heresy.
So it's what the gospel is and what the gospel does.
Yes, what the gospel does, exactly, right? I don't live my life, right, in constant fear of losing my salvation. I mean, I don't, right? I don't have, I mean, why? Why? I mean, we're
I'm answering that today, by the way.
Yeah, that's probably.
I'm going to get at it about 10 different ways.
Yeah, like why? Why would I live? I mean, it's not the gospel. So we come here every Sunday and we listen to the word preached and we have this confession time at, you know, where we confess our sin and we hear the pronouncement of guilt being removed as a reminder every single week. Because, yeah, it's easy to forget. It's easy to get caught up, right? You know, I mean, get off of TikTok, right? I mean, if you're watching TikTok, delete it, please, right? Right? What? It's a challenge. You hold the button down on your iPhone until it starts to blink. You hit that X. Android? I don't know Android, but I'm sure you can delete it too. Same thing. Okay, same thing on Android. Okay? Right? And I mean, are there other things? Are there other voices that you're hearing? Right? You know, I'm picking on TikTok because it's just the worst. But there are others. Voices out there, okay, that are that are bombarding you throughout the week, right? And if those voices, right, that you're listening to, you know, are not healthy for you, you know what I'm talking about? Then, you know, do what you can to cut them off.
Well, even things that are good for us, we make idols of them.
Yes.
At the expense of
the gospel. That's harder to do because it's good for us.
Yep. And by any means, that doesn't mean you get rid of good habits, good behaviors, but that's more of an attitude shift, right? Of putting them in the right place. Right, like what can you get out of life? Like having that right perspective of life. Right.
Maybe that's like a daily asking for discernment from the Holy Spirit. Like just making sure you're in that constant, at least daily prayer with the Lord, that He'll reveal what it is that we may need to change. And I know his revelations come in His timing, right? There may be a period where we get sucked in for His purpose to remind us. I appreciate y'all's thought on that.
Well, we'll be using more and more is that you preach the gospel to yourself every day. And you live this kind of running dialogue in your head when you're confronted with something that is false, right? When the world says you need X, you tell yourself, well, what do I need? Who am I? What's my identity? Is my identity a consumer? Did I need this product that's just been inflated inside of me when previously I didn't even know the product existed, but somehow now I have this desire to want that thing? Or do I say, no, my needs are met in Christ? Now, I'm not saying God's not supplying your needs, or don't get things that you want, right? What I'm saying is don't live in a lifestyle where you're gaining meaning from being a consumer. Right? The gospel tells you that you're not a consumer. The gospel tells you, mixed language here, you've been consumed by Christ.
Right.
That's who wraps you and clothes you and gives you your identity. So I don't need to go buy X or Y or Z to feel like I'm worth something, right? Now the world's going to say, wear these glasses, wear these clothes, drive this car, right? And you can tell yourself, no, I can enjoy the things of the world. I can have glasses and clothes and cars, right? Because they're just things that help me get through this life and enjoy life, right? But I don't have to derive my meaning from them. So there's a good example. So the preaching of the gospel becomes the phraseology that I want us to start using as we combat things in our mind in the way that we choose to live life out of what identity.
Okay.
To David's point, that's the point of Milton Vincent's book, Gospel Primer, is that the Christians often put it that the gospel's for unbelievers to become believers, but for believers as well to continually remind ourselves of those things. But reading the gospel primer is a really good thing toward that end.
Right. So David, would you mind closing us for just a short...
Father, we thank you again for this day, the opportunity to come before you, to be met by you in worship. We thank you that we can meet one another under you. We ask at this time that we share with one another and get ourselves prepared for meeting with you would do well. Thank you for the reminder today through your word concerning wisdom and meaning. And Lord, help us find our meaning in you. This we ask you.
Amen.